days I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight's program is devoted to the subject of environmental justice. Environmental justice is the part of the environmental movement that addresses the effects of environmental degradation and pollution on people, especially poor and powerless people. Though all people ultimately suffer the consequences of a poisoned environment, those who occupy the lowest socioeconomic rungs of society's ladder are the ones who are forced to come into the most direct contact with the sources of health-destroying industrial pollutants, both at home and in the workplace. Our featured speaker tonight, Lois Gibbs, is one of the environmental justice movement's most respected activists. Her own story demonstrates how people without money or influence can organize and become a force to be reckoned with. Lois Gibbs is now the director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice based in Washington, D.C. But she began her fight for environmental justice as a working-class housewife in the area of Niagara, New York, known as Love Canal, a housing development that residents learned had been built atop a toxic chemical waste dump. Lois spoke last fall at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell on building alliances in the environmental justice movement.
Well, welcome everybody. Good afternoon. Welcome to Building Alliances for Environmental Justice Movements, a dialogue with Lois Gibbs and also Ken Geiser. I want to thank you all for coming. My name is Craig Slayton, and I'm faculty here in the College of Health Professions and the co-director of the Center for Public Health Research and Health Promotion, and glad to be welcoming you here today to be able to hear Lois Gibbs and Ken Geiser, and to be able to then engage in some discussion about where we go with the environmental movement and with environmental justice issues. Lois Gibbs is the director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, which grew out of the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste. She is a national leader of the environmental movement and the human rights movement in this country and internationally. I was thinking about introducing Lois, and not anything about Lois, but I started thinking about the Wizard of Oz movie, the story, and the lion and the scarecrow and the Tin Woodsman and Dorothy. And I was thinking that Lois has what all of them were looking for. She has courage, she has intelligence, she has heartfelt compassion, and as Dorothy was saying, there's no place like home. Lois knows the importance of home, and in these days when we're being reminded about homeland security, Lois is one of the people in my life who helped define what security meant in thinking about home and thinking about land and thinking about our health and our environment and the importance of having clean and healthy environment to live in and to work in order to feel secure. It's really quite an honor to have Lois here because her work has been about what her life's work has been about. A lot of that's been built in here to the mission of the university, and I have greetings from the administration, from the chancellor and the provost and the vice chancellor. None of them can make it because the scheduling in this holiday season is a little crazy, but they're all delighted that you're here and sorry that they're not. For those of you who don't know, the mission of UMass Lowell is to support and enhance sustainable regional development. And Lois's leadership has guided the way in this arena for nearly 25 years. And what we mean by sustainable development here, and this is not the official website version of it, but my translation of it, But what we talk about here for sustainable development, among other things, is a clean and healthy environment where people in the region can live free from exposures to toxics, where democracy is promoted, and where we can help people to lead and support the rights of communities to determine what goes on in those communities, how they work, and how they fit into the economic system, and where we want to support and encourage leadership from all citizens, from women, from members of minorities communities, and not just have the same group of people who always have leadership be the ones who take it, and to end racial and economic and social injustice as we build social and economic systems that make it so that we can live in a way that makes it so we can enjoy our lives and protect life for future generations. Lois Gibbs got her start as an environmental activist, as a leader in this nation, protecting her family's health and safety and that of her communities in Niagara area of New York around Love Canal. From that victory, then moved on, actually physically moved on, went to Washington, D.C., and asserted herself as a woman who could be a leader in this country and could set direction for many of us and to encourage other people to take on leadership. And she's been doing that for 25 years and providing strong leadership that many of us here.
Thank you, Craig. I am very honored to be here. And I'm very excited and honored to talk to all of you, in part because I'm playing a role within, and certainly not leading, but playing a role within one of the fastest growing networks and movements in this country. The environmental justice movement, or the grassroots environmental movement, or however you want to frame it, everybody's got their different ways, is one of the fastest growing networks in the country, and it's about making change. It's about city land and town land security. It's about health and safety. It's about looking at trees and bunnies. It's looking at rivers. It's looking at workers. It's looking at pollution. It's looking holistically at what are we going to do? And it's looking at these things from a perspective of not necessarily someone who has a lot of formal education. Most of the leadership in these communities across the country generally don't have more than a high school education. They generally are low income or working class people. They are people who care about the future in the same similar way that we often hear Native Americans speak about seventh generation. And these people are doing just incredible work. But the work they're doing is only partially good if we don't figure out ways to really move this movement for change, for a sustainable environment, for sustainable families, for sustain our own personal lives as well as that of our wildlife and marine life, that it doesn't work unless this movement is more. We need people in the workers' segment. We need people in the corporate segment. We need people in all of the healthcare segment of society because we all have a vested interest in moving this forward. And so for that reason, I'm really proud to be here because there's lots of cash groups and people talking about how do we mix labor and community stuff? How do we move some really, really difficult issues forward? How do we join forces? And so it's an opportunity for me that I'm taking very seriously. And if anybody in this room knows me, I'm also very crude. So I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to be nice. But before I go and be nasty, I wanted to give folks who don't know about Love Canal just a little brief history of what that was and how it came about and help you sort of understand the background of it. Love Canal was a dump site in Niagara Falls, New York. It was rectangular in shape and had 20,000 tons of toxic chemicals in it. Now, back in those days, what the workers did is they brought them in barrels with their bare hands, and they took them to the Love Canal, and they punched holes in the barrel, and they dumped the raw chemicals into this ditch-like rectangular area. Love Canal is 40 feet deep. Bedrock is 40 feet deep. And Love Canal was directly connected to the Niagara River. So essentially what happened is the chemicals would go in very raw. I mean, chemicals like PCBs, chemicals like lindane, which is a pesticide that has been banned in this country. They would go in raw. They would go out through bedrock into the Niagara River. Right downstream from that, we had our drinking water intake because we had a brilliant city government who really thought deeply about these things. And so it came into our water. There were 56 different chemicals in our city drinking water supply. We found out about Love Canal not because our city government shared that with us or the Environmental Protection Agency or the County of Niagara. We found out about Love Canal as homemakers through a local newspaper. Through a local newspaper, they said that Love Canal had all of this waste in it, 20,000 tons, and that, in fact, it was leaking out, and it was leaking out into the community. It was coming up on the surface of the school playground where my son attended kindergarten, the 99th Street School. And there was some concern about the children playing with this yellow substance and other substances. This newspaper very calmly and factually laid out to us. It was shocking. Who would think to build a school, an elementary school, next to a dump and the playground on top of the dump? It was not imaginable to us that a responsible government agency would do such things. 90% of our community, our families, worked in the chemical industry. My husband worked in Goodyear Chemical. Most of the men were working in the industry. Most of the women were not employed outside of the household. We were full-time homemakers, which is much more difficult as a full-time homemaker and now working at a national level. Homemaking was really tough. Nationally, you get lots of help. But we worked in our homes. We took care of our children. And that was sort of the background of the community. Well, when this newspaper came up and we started talking to each other, it wasn't really hard for our neighbors to really grasp the idea that these chemicals are incredibly toxic because they work in the plant. They work with these chemicals. They know at certain levels they must evacuate the area. They know, for example, my husband pointed out to me, well, yeah, we know that's really nasty. You know how we know that, honey? It's like, no, how? Well, because we get paid 25 cents extra an hour to work with that stuff. So it wasn't like we had to convince our neighbors that this is a dangerous area. It was already there. At Love Canal, we had another advantage that I don't often see out in the country as I do traveling, is that we had a great relationship with every single union. We were a union town. We were a chemical town, but we were more a union town. The auto workers, the chemical workers, the steel workers, the teachers, and we were all union families. And we all thought about union as sort of our first connect and the industry our second connect. So at Love Canal, we had incredible support from various labor unions who would provide to us money, printing resources. Their folks would come out and stand on the line with us as we did protests. They gave us their union hall on occasions to do various outreach. We had a relationship that was like this. It was a relationship that was so holistic. I don't see that relationship across the country today. And it's a shame. Because I would rather go into a town and people who greet me and say, well, Lois, we need your help, say, because we are a union shop, we could use your help. Because we are a union town, we can use your help. Because the cash groups explain this stuff to us, we understand we really need your help. Instead of being introduced to the folks in the community saying, we're a company town. And we don't want to mess with them because it's our jobs. At Love Canal, the families there said very clearly that you pay me, not much, but you pay me to come in and work in this plant. And I know how sick people get because I've watched my colleagues and my friends, some of them pass, some of them get sick, some of them out on disability. But you pay me to take that risk. And I know the risk I'm taking, or at least they think they did. But you can't do that. There is no price to put on my children and my wife's head. They're not being compensated, nor is there a way to ever compensate them. And it was that whole psychology that the workers walked away with, that I might be willing to put myself at risk to support my family, but my family will not be put at risk. My family is first, my union is before the company, and that's how we organized at Love Canal, and organized in a way that we were incredibly successful in less than 2 years. We learned a lot at Love Canal. We learned that the support of workers and the cash groups were incredibly important, because we could hear something from the government who said, oh, that benzene level is really high, but you know what? It's not really a risk. And then the cash groups would say, well, do you know benzene causes cancer? No, they said it wasn't. Do you know that it causes leukemia? No, we didn't know that. Do you know it causes miscarriages? And they would talk to us in lay language. They would talk to us in a way that we could really understand what was happening, but more importantly, really understand how our government and our health agencies at that time were not telling us the whole truth. Were they lying? No. But they weren't telling us the whole truth. And I'll give you an example. At Love Canal, we had 56% of our children in our neighborhood born in a five-year period. 56% of those births were birth-defected children. And these children had 3 years, extra rows of teeth, extra fingers, extra toes, double rows, you know, just all of mentally retarded. It was devastating. And so, you know, we talked to people in the health and union shop sort of communicators folks, and they were mostly cash people, and, you know, health and safety folks. And they said, well, you know, some of these chemicals actually cause birth defects, and it does in, you know, guinea pigs, and it has in workers, and you should really be concerned about that. Well, when we raised it with the state and said, look what's going on, you can't tell us there's not a problem here. You can't tell us that we've got to be moved from here. They would say, well, first of all, of course, it was useless housewife data, because we're not scientists, and it was true, we're not scientists. But then when we forced them to pay attention to it, they came back to us and said, we have confirmed your finding. We don't disagree that 56% of the children in Love Canal were born birth defected. We don't disagree with that. However, we don't believe it's related to Love Canal. And when we asked them what they do think it was related to, seeing 20,000 tons were in the center of the neighborhood, they said that they believed it was a case of random clustering of genetically defective people. That's not a lie. If you were a statistician, you could actually do a calculation that would come out and say, yeah, that's, you know, I mean, it's a possibility. Likely as none, but it's a possibility. So they actually didn't lie to us, because I don't want to say that, but they took the truth and they manipulated it so it was their agenda. What we were able to do was use the people that we knew who had been working on this issue, again, through the unions to help us, and through universities, especially SUNY and Roswell Park, where we had some scientists, to really help us understand this thing and move forward. It was a result of 900 people getting involved and staying involved and being actively involved, running a democratic organization. Everybody in our community had a right to vote. There wasn't a subcommittee or an executive committee who sat on somebody's living room and made all the decisions and then presented them to the larger group. We actually presented the whole gamut of options to the larger group, and they got to vote on it and make their own decisions about moving forward. And it was very hard in the leadership role to know that when they're moving forward on a couple of occasions, they were doing it, like, totally wrong. It was just going to, like, really be bad, that we were really going to get hurt. But letting them go through it was a lesson, a whole host of lessons that they learned. And so while they were going through it and we knew it was, the results were going to be terrible, we were having a counter plan to fix it in the other side of the room. So it was about helping our folks also grow to be leaders, to challenge power, to challenge the establishment in different ways. But the 900 families, actually, we won relocation for everyone who wished to leave. We challenged the understanding of health for women and children, 24 hours exposure to low-level chemicals. We challenged the government to come up with a solution to the other love canals, which was mapped out across the country by Congress. They said there's 50,000 other of these all over the nation. I actually think there's probably more than that. They did back down. But we came up with a process to begin to deal with the other love canals and the other working class communities and poor communities who are facing these same issues. So as a result, Superfund was born at the end of 1980 under Jimmy Carter's administration. And Superfund, I don't know how many of you all know it, but it's money that's set aside for cleaning up hazardous waste sites. Superfund was born, many people call me the mother of Superfund. I don't know whether that's good or bad. But if I'm the mother of Superfund, I will say that Superfund was born very healthy program. And the Republicans tortured it. And they tortured it so badly that the program doesn't work. It's a crippled child now, a physically and politically challenged child now that doesn't go anywhere. It was a wonderful program that was meant to help people. It doesn't have funding. It hasn't been funded since 1996. It has no money in Superfund, and the money has been coming from general revenues in our larger budget, their general budget. Now, with all this money going towards the war effort, the terrorist effort, the home security effort, there will be no money for Superfund. So here was a wonderful program that Ronald Reagan and his friends tortured and ruined and crippled for life that now won't even have any money for what little it does do. People in the grassroots movement are very concerned about this. Right to Know, which Ken is going to talk about, is also a piece of Superfund, a piece of that same effort by the movement. And that's about getting information off of the web and other places to find out what's happening in your community. And that, too, they want to take down. But those were major victories. The movement was on the move. Our movement was growing. And our movement at that time was growing in a very broad way, where we had lots of people from different walks of life coming together and working on federal legislation and state legislation and source reduction and all of those sort of things. And then something happened. The grassroots movement continued to build at the local level and still is building. But this larger movement of professionals and universities in some cases slowed down and almost to a trickle. The national movement from wildlife preservation, forest preservation, rivers, toxics, went away. They weren't visible. I mean, they were there, but they weren't visible. Something happened to our movement to stall it at this level. The grassroots level, again, is still continuing to grow. But it stalled it at that level. And the question was, what happened? Why in the last 8 to 10 years have we not really been able to achieve change? You're all here. You care about this issue. I have 8,000 groups that we work with who care about this issue across the country. So why haven't we been able to do that? And I believe the reason we didn't do that is because Clinton and Gore got into office. Clinton and Gore are not bad people, obviously. I voted for them. But when Clinton and Gore got into office, everybody stopped pushing. Everybody stopped growing. Even if you have a good person in office, you know, the industry, the opponents are there, and they're in their face big time because they know they have to be in their face big time because they're not a friend, they're more a foe. And where were we? There was nobody from our side beating up on Al. Al Gore was not being beat up on. Clinton was not being challenged to do the right thing. The standards on right to know, the standards around Superfund, the standards around workers' rights, they were at a standstill, paralyzed, and some went backwards. I think this is a huge learning for all of us, that we really need, and there's some theories out there, that we are the last generation of people who can correct the wrong before it's permanent. And the wrong meaning saving the planet itself, saving the wildlife, but what's especially important to me is saving ourselves. Every time these children become poisoned, every time a woman becomes poisoned in the workplace and in the community, it's the same. Women have so many chemicals in their breast milk today that if you were to bottle breast milk, a very natural, the most healthy thing to feed a child, and still is, by the way, if you were to bottle it and try to put it on a shelf and sell it, it would be banned. It would be too poisoned, too contaminated to put on a shelf. How did that happen? Well, it happened in the workplace. It happened in the communities. It happened in our food supply. What's happening to our children that live in the communities, who mom and dads work in places that are contaminated? In the last decade, children 0 to 4 years of age have an increase of cancer, brain and central nervous system cancer, of 53%. These are children 0 to 4, and we're talking brain and central nervous cancer. I mean, this is a serious disease. 0 to 4, increased by 53%. They're not in the plant, but their moms are, and their dads are. They're in the plant, and then they go home to the community, and they get dually poisoned. It's connected. But as an organization, as a movement, we aren't connected. If you look at how many children in public schools, for the teachers' unions know this very well, how many children in public schools now need special education? How many have learning disabilities? My two children, after Love Canal, I gave birth to two kids, and both of them have learning disabilities. Both of them are in special ed in our public school system in my neighborhood. Is that because of my exposure to Love Canal? Is it genetics? I don't know. What I do know is that this increase is not about better testing. This increase is about every time we give birth, every time we feed our child, and every time our child drinks milk or eats cheese, our children are getting poisoned. This is a movement that really crosses all boundaries. It's a movement that crosses all living species, whether it's plant, animal, marine life, or human life. And it's a movement that we really, really, really need to figure out how to pull together. One of the things that I want to talk about is how we can do this with workers and work-related cash groups and health groups. That it is so important. There are a number of examples out there, such as in Louisiana, where the workers were locked out of their plant, a BASF plant, and how the community had been complaining about that plant anyhow. The workers were locked out on a contract, but they were also concerned about health and safety inside the plant. And once the workers got locked out, the community, who was also concerned, joined forces with the workers. And together, for many, many years, they fought this huge corporation. And the result of that is that the workers got back into the plant, got pretty much what they wanted, not all of what they wanted, and the community got this reduction of contaminants going out into the neighborhood. Those are the type of things that we need to figure out how we can do in community after community after community across this country. If you look at the right to know and what happened as a result of that, I mean, some of the plants and the corporations across this country went and reduced their toxins because they didn't want people to know what was going on. change their chemicals because they didn't want people to think that they're really terrible polluters and don't give a hoot about human health and the environment. A lot of actual plant-related, industrial-related changes came from just informing the public of what is going on. So we've moved a long way as a society and as a movement to try and fix those things. But now we have to take the next step. And it's not happening. I go to communities, and I said this earlier to the advisory group, and in these communities, there is no talking, there is no discussion between the two groups of people. And it's become a major issue because we have a dioxin campaign. Dioxin campaign is about eliminating dioxin in the environment and therefore in our bodies and therefore in our breast milk and down the line. Well, to eliminate dioxin, we're talking about a huge workforce. People who are in the workforce who use chlorine, it's all chlorine-based, and a huge part of our industrial economic base has a chlorine base to it. So now what do we do with these workers of Niagara Falls, for example, which is a huge place where chlorine is a main element in the industrial sector? What do we do in Niagara Falls? How do we talk to the labor in Niagara Falls and say, you know what, we've got to stop doing this? What is the counter? What is the just transition? And a lot of people are talking about just transition across the country, but it doesn't mean anything. If you're a worker standing outside the Occidental Petroleum plant and I'm knocking on your door and saying, you know what, we got to fix this. Y'all are sick. The neighborhood is sick. Niagara Falls is not getting any better. You can't find a place within a half mile of a known toxic site in the city of Niagara Falls and Niagara County. Think about that. That's huge. So what are we going to do? We, the people, have to stop it. This is our community. This is our city. And they say, well, what are we going to do for livelihood? I don't know. And somehow we need to figure those out. Not in the grand plan. There is a grand plan up there about training and education and funding and for the workers and stuff. But what do we do before we get there? If you look at the right to know legislation or some of the other legislation that's been incredibly successful to both our organizations and movements, is that it started at the grassroots level. The right to know started in the workplace. It was the workers who moved that agenda. And then it moved to some of the environmentalists and workers working together on cities like Philadelphia. And then when it was all over the country and DuPont had to fill out 500 different forms for 500 different cities and different plants, they got really pissed. And they said, you know what? We need a consistent law. And then it was time to move to the federal level. So when we're talking about just transition or building a base, we really need to talk about what are the incremental steps we can take and how can those incremental steps then lead us in the same model as, for example, the right to know, lead us to federal legislation because we can't begin there. It's not going to happen. It's not realistic and it's not going to pay off in the long haul. How do we talk to corporations in a way that's positive? How do we talk to them about what we can do for them if they change? Now, we're not talking at the national level, but we're actually talking about in community by community. We're talking about corporations who have companies all across the United States. How do we talk to the guy, for example, the middle guy? You know, he's got management up here, and he's trying to deal with the community over here and the workers over there. And he's sort of the go-between. So what is it that he can then go tell management that we are able and capable and willing to do to make their life really miserable? You know, and how do we do that? And what is the model for that? And who should be involved in playing that game? And where can we experiment with that? One of the ideas that came from the old OCAW, which is now PACE Union, was that in Niagara Falls, one of the reasons that industry is there and do what they do is because they're very high energy, intensive energy industrial complexes. And so in Niagara Falls, because of the Niagara Falls and the hydropower and all of that stuff, there are huge subsidies that are given to these corporations based on how many people they hire. Now they hire 50 and fire 48, and they get their subsidy, or lay off 48. So we're trying to figure out, well, what could we do? So there was analysis done by the union, which was pretty eye-opening. The subsidies given to Occidental in particular, because they're the ones I fought at Love Canal, so I have to keep on picking on them. In Occidental, the money, the subsidy money that Occidental got per year on an annual basis is equivalent to $60,000 per worker, from the secretary to the plant manager. The workers were not making $60,000. And in fact, at Love Canal back then, because this was some time ago, my husband worked at Goodyear and he made $10,000 a year. So here's this industry who's getting $60,000 in subsidies that essentially covers their payroll. Well, that can't be. It was shocking. So there was a decision that what we really need to do is take over the subsidy board. It's not an elected position, and it's sort of appointed, and we knew how to do it. So the union was talking about, we'll take over the subsidy board, we'll change the subsidies, and then we'll also attach the subsidies to different type of industries. Industries that are high energy use industries, but sustainable industries. So they're not industries that are going to pollute, but rather they need a lot of energy to produce whatever they produce, but it's sustainable in the sense that it's not unhealthy for the workers, and it's not unhealthy for the community, and certainly the Niagara Frontier, which is one of the seven wonders of the world. More ideas like that, in ways in which we can implement ideas like that, we can change both the industry on a local level and eventually the industries at a national level. But again, we need to figure out, how do we put this together? There's always the struggle between jobs and environmentalists, that we, those who are very familiar, certainly within the union, understand totally. There was an interesting story out in Tacoma, Washington, where Ruckelhaus, who was an administrator of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, went out there. They had this smelter that was putting all of this contamination in the air, huge amount, I mean, very, very unsafe. And the workers were all sick and getting lung cancer and different diseases. And Ruckelhaus went out there and had a meeting with both the community people who were concerned about their children and their family and the workers in the smelter industry and said, okay, which one do you guys want? You choose, because I can't. How dare they? And this happens time and time again all across the country. You choose. You want jobs or environment. But the reality is both of those can work together. But what happens in real life is a community says, well, we want health, and the workers say, we want jobs, and there's nothing in between. And suddenly they're not together. They're absolutely not together. They're together in spirit. They're together in principle. They're certainly together in heart. But they have these separate interests. So how do we get over that barrier? How do we at first make an agreement that we're going to go in and these are the boundaries? These are the high, these are the low, and this is our negotiating space. How do we do that in a powerful way? And what do we learn from that? And I think if we do it a few times, we can be more educated about how to do it better, and hopefully enough so that we really can move this agenda. At CHEJ, we have a schools campaign. And this is where they're building new schools across the country. And one of the places they're building these schools are on top of brownfields, old contaminated industrial sites. And the way that they work, the decision makers do it in that area, is they tell, and it's almost all low-income communities, they don't build these polluted schools in white, rich neighborhoods. Not that it really matters, because usually white rich neighborhoods send their kids to private school anyhow, and wouldn't go to public. But they're almost all Latino, African American, Asian American. It's all of these sort of low income and communities of color. So then they sell to the teachers that the teachers have to choose. Do they want the technology and the new building and the resources for their students, and possibly even smaller class size, which is what they always use and never give, even if they agree? Do you want this for your students so that they can be well-educated and ready to really enter the workplace when they grow up? Or do you want a safe place to work and teach. These are your choices. Those are not choices. We should not accept those as choices. It's not either or. And where we've seen parents and teachers link arm and say, they're not choices. What we want is a school with the resources for our students to learn and prosper, and we want it in an area that does not jeopardize our health and environment. That the children are out there playing on the field, playing on the campus, these children must have a clean place to do that. And in that case, actually the school board found suddenly extra money to do a better cleanup of the brownfields. Since in urban areas, it's very difficult to get pristine land, so sometimes that's the only option that they have. Why can't we do this in other communities? How do we connect these networks in a way that makes sense? How do we, once we connect them, convince the decision makers, convince the corporations, and come up with some unique strategies to think about not control technology, but rather preventative technology? How do we get them not to talk about, well, we'll reduce the amount that will go out into the river or into the air that goes downwind to the children's school, and that will be okay. And how do we get them to say, you know what, we're going to stop putting things out in that stack. We're going to really be a good neighbor. We're going to really be a good corporation. How do we move that forward? How can you and I and others come together to talk about precaution? We have in the streets all of the right elements. In the movement that I'm associated with, we have, and this will sound very crude, but we have the moms who will stand in front of the cameras and cry. And we all know if it leads, it bleeds. No, if it bleeds, it leads. We have that piece. We have huge public support. We have the voting masses as well as the unions in moving politics, right? We have creative strategies. We have, as community people, we have more ways to move that are outside the box. You know, if you're in a union or some other sort of organization, there's a certain behavior that's acceptable and unacceptable, and that's okay, and we put it on the table. But in the community movement, there is none of those rules, right? So what you can't do, we can do. And what we can't do, you can do. And, you know, where do we start and how do we move it? It's very exciting opportunity for us now, especially because we have Bush as president. Everybody knows everybody's going to get messed with. There's nobody who's saying, except for the corporate guys, there's nobody who's saying, no, good. This is going to happen. And it's unfortunate because if we were as active when Clinton and Gore were presidents as we are going to be with the Bush administration and are with the Bush administration as much as we can after 9/11, think of what we might have gotten. I mean, it's just immeasurable what we could have achieved, but we didn't. And so I'm proposing that there has to be some way over the next 2 years to figure out a way in which we can move together, that we can come up with strategies, whether the strategies is just tied out on a single corporation or with a single union around schools or, you know, something, but a strategy to figure out what works and what doesn't work. How do we move it forward and how do we do it collectively with all of the people we know and all of the people we're working with? Because I think that's the answer to building a better, safer tomorrow and workplace. Because if we don't, our futures are really grim from all sectors. It's not just about workers. It's not just about communities. It's not just about healthcare providers or teachers or the woman who answers the phone. It's about all of us. I mean, one thing that we used to talk about many years ago is that it's we, us against them. It's the bigger us. And think of the possibilities of the bigger us against them, whoever them are. Think of the possibilities. And how do we use our young people? Where are our young people and how do we use it? You know, when you look at it, I'm a executive director of a national environmental group. I'm only here because of the women's movement. You know, our young people on the campuses are vital resources who have energy and spirit and creativity and time and a vested interest in the outcome. You know, you look at the peace movement. You know, that happened because of the campus activities. You look at even the civil rights movement many decades ago. It was the young people sitting at the counter who didn't win the movement, but it added a big element to their ability to win. And so how do we also look beyond what we have here, working on, you know, prevention and sustainability and worker-based issues and community natural-based issues and environmental justice-based issues? How do we look beyond that and pull together? Because it would just be phenomenal. We live in a democracy. We often forget that we live in a democracy. We are in control. We really are. I mean, corporations do their big ads and they do their campaign things and they buy people. But we get to vote. We need to figure out how we get those people to the polls to vote. We need how to figure out how we have a candidate that's worth voting for. We need to figure these things out. In Quincy, Mass. Is a little city. I don't know if you all are familiar with it, but sort of a little city outside of Boston. And they were fighting the school issue there, and they won the school issue. They tried to put a school on the dump site, and the parents stopped it. But they turned over the mayor of the city of Quincy. One of their leadership people are the mayor of the city of Quincy. Half of their city council turned over. So now 50% of their city council and the mayor all believe that something needs to be done in Quincy, Massachusetts to not only clean up the environment, but to protect the students and the teacher and other school personnel from this contamination. I mean, that's what we need to do in every community across this country. And we need to figure out how to do it. And I believe we can do it. We have the power. We have the knowledge. We have to take some more risks. People are afraid to take risks. It's okay. In every movement and everything like this, and certainly you all know it in the labor movement, people die. People get hurt, but progress is made. People get embarrassed. People get fired, but progress is made. That we need to be willing to take those risks. We need to get outside of our comfort zone and need to figure it out. And I truly, truly believe working together, sharing, using people of all ages, of all classes, of all ethnic backgrounds, standing up, that we can change this country. We can take control of this country in a way that it actually represents the people who live here and work here. We can stop poisoning the men and women, the mothers, the children. We're all in this together. We have to stop thinking of ourselves as being separate. Stop letting them convince us that we're separate. Talk about what's going to happen before you walk into the meeting. This is what they're going to say. This is how they're going to say it. They're going to try to divide us, and here is our wrap. You know, just like the canvassers at the door. Here's our wrap. No matter what they say, here's our wrap. And it'll work. And we can change it. And so I hope we're able to do that. I hope we can figure out how to do that. I think it's really fun talking about creative strategies to do that. But I really think we need to figure out this way. We need to share. And we just need to link. It's us against them. And if we think about us against them, we can control the world. Thanks.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Thank you very much, Lois. That was a very moving talk. I'd like to introduce Dr. Ken Geiser, who's on the faculty of the Department of Work Environment here at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's also the director of the Toxics Use Reduction Institute and co-director of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. Dr. Geiser is going to talk with us some about the efforts to roll back right-to-know provisions that we've won that Lois was talking about. And he's someone, along with Lois and quite a few other people, who, as they say, spent 9 months of their lives in 1985 and 1986 trying to get legislation and succeeding for community right-to-know. So, Ken?
Thanks a lot, Craig. I'm an old enough organizer to know that one of the things you never do on a podium like this is follow Lois Gibbs. I actually pleaded that I be the warm-up act for this so that we could build toward Lois, but actually Lois, I think as you can see, has once again sort of codified the whole question about risk and community and the kinds of differences between those who actually suffer and stand for safety and security in the society and those who purport risk and danger. What I want to do is talk a little bit about Right to Know. Lois mentioned this, and I just want to update people a little on what's going on at the moment. It's a very interesting time for people like ourselves who for many years have struggled to try to bring to the attention of government officials and corporate officials the conditions that take place in industrial facilities that where dangerous and lethal and toxic materials are stored and used. And that over and over again, our advocacy has been around the question of safety and the question around security. And that we've asked that the government and corporate policies try to guarantee a safer system of production such that our families and communities are safe. So it's a bit surprising lately to see in the last month and a half that the chemical industry and the chemical industry's trade group is in Congress at this point arguing that its facilities are not safe, that they are dangerous. In fact, they're quite vulnerable facilities. They're vulnerable to terrorists and vulnerable to terrorist attack. And the proper way to address this is to do essentially what the government did for the airline industry, which is provide an enormous new source of funding to, quote, harden the chemical industry facilities, put up larger fences, increase the number of guards at the facilities, do all kinds of investigations of employees to find out criminal backgrounds, to basically attempt in every other way than the most obvious way to reduce the risks of these facilities. And the most obvious way is obviously to change the production system itself. So I think it's an interesting time. This is a struggle going on right now in budget issues and some of the appropriation committees. But it's interesting to take a look back at how we've found the table so turned on who's saying that the chemical facilities are dangerous and vulnerable, because that was always our line. And I think it's important to recognize, as Lois did, that the earliest formation, earliest demands in this country for Right to Know, information about chemical hazards in the workplace and in the facilities, industrial facilities, came from workers, came from working people and their trade unions who struggled during the early part of the 1980s to try to move forward what were known at that point as worker Right to Know legislation. And in many ways, I think we can be pleased that the Hazard Communication Standard, which became the sort of unified national OSHA standard for guaranteeing that workers do have some access to that information, was a result of the many grassroots efforts in working places and in communities to try to create information for workers. In 1984, the tragedy of Bhopal caught the attention of the world and taught us how necessary it was to provide information to communities as well as workers. And in the years that followed that, in the write-up, the amendments to the Superfund Reauthorization Act, Title III was added, the Emergency Response and Community Right to Know provisions, which for the first time also guaranteed that firms would have to report to the public on the kinds of toxic materials that they released from those facilities into the public air and waterways and land. And for many of you who've worked with the Toxics Release Inventory, you know what a valuable tool this has been and how important it's been, not only at our own advocacy, but also in creating the incentives that Lois mentioned for moving companies to try to take better responsibility for the chemicals that they release from their facilities. Now, release is one thing. use is another. Risk, hazard, during accidents is another. And in 1990, we won another additional piece of the Right to Know puzzle, which was in the amendments to the Clean Air Act in 1990. We won provisions that would require that thousands of chemical processing facilities in the country would have to create something called risk management plans, which were plans that would identify the hazards in their facilities and create emergency response provisions for what would take place in the case of those hazards. But what was particularly useful in there was something called the offsite consequences assessments. And that was that the regulations required that the chemical companies, hundreds of them at this point, needed to create scenarios on what would be the most dramatic, worst-case conditions that would take place if there was an explosion or an accident at the facilities. And these things, these became known as the worst-case scenarios, were to be provided to the public, were to be provided to the neighborhoods, so that people living near the chemical processing facilities would not only know that they were in a zone of endangerment during an accident, such as the Bhopal accident, but also that emergency responders and others could pull people together to build a reliable system for responding in those kinds of cases. And then we saw a resistance begin to build. And the resistance first came from the chemical industries, the facility owners and managers themselves, who basically argued that this information put out in the public would not only be quite frightening to the public, unnecessarily so, but also could fall into the wrong hands and could be used as an invitation to various kinds of terrorist activities. And to their clever benefit, what they did is they enlisted the FBI as an ally in this. And with the aid of the FBI, they put a great deal of pressure on the EPA to not release the information in the worst-case scenarios. And the grassroots and environmental communities fought back and struggled, and there was eventually achieved a compromise, which is that while the risk management plans and summaries would be made available on the Internet, that the worst-case scenarios would be only available in hard copy in a very small number of libraries on something called a read-only basis, no photocopying, please, such that people might be able to get this information, but it would be through very constrained activities. So then, in September, we had the tragic accidents in Pennsylvania, Washington, and New York. And what the September 11th incidents did to Right to Know was an immediate hysterical reaction. And the first thing that the EPA did within 2 weeks after September 11th was to shut down all of the information, the thousands and thousands of pages on the Internet, on the risk management plans. In addition, the Department of Transportation closed down all of its Internet sites on the pipelines, on the fuel pipelines around the country and fuel storage facilities. The USGS shut down all of its information on drinking water supplies, on where the reservoirs were and what their supply rates were to the various communities. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry pulled its 1999 study known as Industrial Chemicals and Terrorism, a study that really anticipated what might happen at these facilities were they attacked by terrorists. And then we began to see action at the states as well. I watched from the point of view of state professionals, friends of mine, who watched as Pennsylvania shut down all of its information around water supplies, toxic chemicals. New Jersey, the other state, which has a really wonderful database on chemical use, sharply curtailed and eventually closed much of its database on toxic chemical use in New Jersey. And even the NGOs were not immune. The U.S. PERG actually withdrew its recent publication on risks at fertilizer plants under a great deal of pressure from the government itself. So in the wake of the September 11th tragedies, what we saw was an enormous move to try to close down one of the big victories that we in the environmental and citizen movements had achieved over a 20-year period, which was getting information available to the public about chemical hazards at industrial facilities. So I wasn't particularly surprised when I got the phone call myself. As a director of the Toxics Use Reduction Institute, we have a database. We put up data on the some 500 facilities in Massachusetts that use toxic chemicals in the state in quantities over 10,000 pounds or more. And that database is available to community people to find out what chemicals are used, not just released, but used in the facilities in their neighborhoods and communities. And it has been an enormously valuable database. I thought it was kind of amusing the way the call came to me. The call came from the regulatory division, the Department of Environmental Protection, and it turned out that it had come about because the lawyers at the DEP had decided that they should shut down the various databases as New Jersey had that might fall into the wrong hands. And so they had found that we had this toxic use reduction database, so they decided they would close down the DEP's database. And then they discovered that the DEP did not own the database, that the database was owned by the institute at the university. And so there was a sort of subtle call I got rather than a commanding call, which was, many states are closing down their databases. We're wondering what you're going to do about yours, is the way it got framed to me. My response was pretty quick, and I said, look, we're a university. Our job is education and information, and that's what we're in the business of, and we aren't shutting down this database. That created quite a bit of a... quite a bit of a stir, as you might guess, because I'm a nice guy and everybody kind of likes to get along with me and I don't get hard very often. But it came down to was a whole bunch of negotiations with me, and the only thing we've actually agreed to is that we would ask people to identify themselves when they use the database, which I'm not particularly happy about. But on the other hand, the information is up, it's on the web, it's usable, and it is still there. Now, I think that the lessons here are important, and that is that I think the events of September 11th have once again revealed very starkly to us what many of us know, the chemical and other petroleum and other industries know as well and don't like to talk about, which is this very advanced industrial society is built on highly lethal, hazardous, and poisonous chemicals. And that the products and services that we enjoy in our economy, many are produced using dangerous materials that set workers at risk and set communities at risk. Whether it's chlorine used in disinfecting water supplies, and by the way, when we did a little look at using our database to try to identify, well, what highly explosive chemicals are being stored at facilities around Massachusetts, what are the largest amounts of those? We found that chlorine was the largest amount. And it's used mostly for wastewater disinfection and drinking water disinfection. And there are large tanks of it around, which are potential sites for mischievous behavior. But it's not just chlorine. Chlorine is, of course, one. It's uranium in nuclear energy facilities. It's pesticides in agricultural facilities stored in large tanks. It's cyanide stored for plating and plastics manufacturing. Many different operations store highly explosive, inflammable, and dangerous chemicals on their facilities. It is critical to understand that we need to attend to that, that we need to reduce the hazardousness and the potential for risk and threat that comes from these chemical processing facilities. But what is important is that we need to resist the effort to reduce those risks by, quote, hardening the facilities. Building bigger fences, putting in more guard dogs, and checking the criminal records of workers is not going to assure us safe chemical processing. The only way we're going to get to safe chemical processing is to build inherently safe processing facilities. And that means not only reconsidering the production systems, but it means reconsidering the materials themselves. And here's my little plug for a book. I wrote a book on this, so it's recently out, and you're all invited to buy it. It's called Materials Matter, and the argument of the book is essentially that we can use the brilliant ingenuity and capacity and talent and energy of our scientific and technical and popular communities to really move toward a safer system of materials. And only that is going to provide for us not only a set of industrial processes that guarantee us the kind of products and services that we want in our lives without the kind of risks that Lois Gibbs had to fight in Niagara, New York, around the Love Canal facility, and thousands of other families have had to mobilize around. And that workers everywhere in this country and around the world, increasingly around the world, are exposed to. And that consumers are exposed to as we try to consume the products. Only by moving to more inherently safe systems of production, materials that fit better into the natural systems of the planet, and chemicals that are compatible with our own bodies such that we can live successfully and safely with the products that we actually are trying to use and enjoy. That is the mission that we should be about in this next century. This university, the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, an enormous resource of technical talent, is going to be playing a major role in that. I'm proud to say that because of all of the people here, many of you in this room, but all the people that I know and work with here at the university. I am pleased that this university has taken a position to seek as its mission a sustainable region, a sustainable industrial region, and that our chancellor and others have committed us in that direction. And so for Craig and the people here who work within the hazardous waste worker training programs, and for folks who work in my operation, the Toxic Use Reduction Institute, for those who are working in the centers around regional economic social development, and all the many different groups in advanced chemistry and some of the really wonderful things in bioprocessing and biopolymers, etc., I think we hold one of the keys to that vision. So it's great to be able to speak to you. It's great to be on this platform with Lois Gibbs, who's a friend and a colleague I've known for a long time, and someone who's really been a great proponent of mobilizing people to demand a better and safer society. Because one of the real pleasures of writing the book was doing the historical section. Because the historical section really taught me that the only true lasting voice for safety and security has been the people of this country. That's who we need to trust. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a talk by environmental activists Lois Gibbs and Ken Geiser on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests.